Vicky Featherston, welcome to TheatreVoice.com. Just to start, really, can you tell us a little bit about the play 365 by David Harrow, which you're directing at the Edinburgh Fringe?
Yeah, it started a while ago. I've been thinking for ages about how to examine child poverty. Big question, me and Gordon Brown both. I'd been thinking for a long time about the kind of hypocrisy of a kind of civilised, in inverted commas, society where basically there was this massive sort of surge of fear about what children are and what children can be and an inability to deal with them. But I've got two children of my own, and as they were getting older I felt kind of nervous that what I was trying to do was some kind of sentimental sort of Andrex puppy dog thing, and I hadn't found the way to explore this properly. And then about kind of 8 months ago now, I was talking to somebody who happens to be a trustee of Barnardo's, and she was telling me, you know, statistic after statistic about looked after kids and care leavers at 16 and this kind of thing. And the Barnardo's have a project called 16 Plus, where they have practice flats where the 16-year-olds go to learn to be adults. And in that moment, the whole idea kind of went from this sort of sprawling kind of emotional thing that I had going on into an absolutely focused, tight, dramatic form, if you like, to say, well, actually, if we use the flat as the space where you go in a child and need to come out an adult, then all things can happen within that space. And then I realised actually we had something to start with as a piece of theatre. So I then approached David Harrower, whose the last play he wrote was Blackbird, to see whether he'd be interested in writing it. And he said he would, but neither of us knew at all where it was going to go. And we employed a television researcher, who's the researcher I employed to do Blackwatch, who's brilliant, and she did a lot of research, and we started doing some workshops around the research, and decided that we would form it into 365.
Is this a normal way for Harrow to work, to be commissioned to work on a particular idea? Isn't it normal for him to really begin with his own idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think normal's a really good thing. There's nothing normal about this. No, it's it isn't a normal way for him to work. It's also not a normal way for me to work, because my history has been actually receiving the brilliant plays from the writers who've written them in their bedrooms and struggled over them, with sort of minor input at various stages. So it's kind of different for both of us. But it feels very exciting. It feels quite liberating, because it's about not having to solve anything individually. It's about asking the questions collaboratively and going off to try to solve elements of those individually, but knowing that actually the process of making the piece itself will answer the questions. We don't need to know them before we go into rehearsals.
And the subject matter in some ways sounds as if it's a kind of thing which would lend itself to a naturalistic, almost soap opera or kitchen sink drama type piece, but that's not Harrower's style, and
no.
I imagine that Harrower hasn't written that kind of play.
No, absolutely not. I mean, we've been very clear about asking the questions of what is interesting in this to put on stage theatrically and dramatically that wouldn't be, although I think they're fantastic, a Ken Loach film or a documentary or a small domestic piece about one character. And for me, it was about trying to find a kind of dramatic form to communicate the scale of this issue. And by putting it into a kind of three-hander play in a studio theatre, could still let the audience leave going, that poor character. And it's not. It's a really different approach that we're taking. Mm-hmm. So the kind of 365 is really useful coming up with that title, because it's about the fact that, you know, it just goes on and on and on, and anywhere, any day, on any place, and then the year, this could be happening. And I think that's the thing that's really, really shocked us about it. But also, as we've gone into it further and we started to do research, there is a massive inconsistency across the kind of care system in terms of what care leavers get or what their lives have been like. But the thing that really began to engage us was the kind of lack of therapeutic care for these young people. 80% of them have got serious mental health problems. And when people are talking about enabling them to be adults, they're talking about vital things, but, you know, budgeting, cooking, that kind of thing. Actually, they nearly all have attachment disorder. They're not attuned socially. They're not in control of what their past stories are at all. So there's no way they can become, as we expect them to become, responsible adults. So the piece very quickly moved from what is the actual truth of what happens in that flat to what is in the heads of these young people, and will they ever be able to become adults as we define adulthood.
And how many characters are in this play?
I don't know how many characters there are, but there's 14 actors, 13 sort of younger, between sort of 16 and 25 actors, and one slightly older. At the moment, there's probably about sort of 12 or 13 characters emerging, but I think there'll probably be more by the time we've been in rehearsals. We're kind of looking at it, the specific characters that have specific stories, and there's one character in particular who, if you were going to drop everything else, might become the naturalistic play. We thought it would be important to have something which threaded all the way through, to make us understand a more straightforward journey, if you like, that would then allow us to go off into kind of slightly more sort of flights of fancy to explore other areas of the stories that we want to explore, but maybe less connected to a linear narrative.
And how did you go about the process of casting the young actors?
We've kind of swithered as we've gotten on. We started off and I kind of wondered whether or not we should be looking for very young people who maybe not define themselves as actors professionally yet and that kind of thing, but then I realised very quickly that that was a very different sort of show. Shows which we've seen, especially in Scotland recently, quite a lot of, actually, brilliantly and very excitingly, but that actually this was about a writer like David being able to respond to this material, and therefore he would be creating quite technically complex characters. And actually that's not about a single voice on stage, that's about actors who have a technical ability and are trained or not, but who can find their way through that. So we've gone about it with our brilliant casting director, and we've auditioned and workshopped at probably about 100 young actors, and we kind of refined that down to our last process, which was about 3 weeks ago, when we saw 27 over 2 days and came up with this final list of 13. And it's an amazing array of young Scottish acting talent. It's extraordinary, the people that are in it, really. It's very exciting.
You mentioned the play having flights of fancy. Now, without asking you to give too much away, I mean, what can we expect from the play in terms of, as I say, Harrower's predilection for a non-naturalistic approach to theatre?
Yeah. It's very much about the theatre as a for us. This might change, but for us, it's about the theatre as a place where we can try to find the truth. We might be able to try to find the truth about something. So the form and the process of it is about trying to search for a moment of truth. The really extraordinary thing about these characters, these children with attachment disorder, is they often don't know what their own truth is because it's become so fragmented and so broken by their experience. And we have this obsession with wanting to know what their story is, their backstory. Actually, they don't exist through that. They exist in a moment where they just survive in the present through behaviour. So we're putting on stage behaviour rather than backstory. So we might never know what the stories of these characters are. And so as a result of that, what we're trying to create in the space and theatre is an urgency for stories for the audience to want to know a story, but the character not have a desire to tell it, the character have a desire to survive in any moment. So as a result of that, the stage becomes a big space for exploring that in and exploring their need for escape from the present and all of those things. So, yeah, without giving anything away, it's about that exploration rather than about the flat itself.
Just to kind of change gear a little bit, Vicky, I mean, here you are doing a Harrower play, and there's also this forthcoming festival going to be a new play by Zinnie Harris, and there's a lot of talk about playwriting in Scotland. How do you, as an English woman directing the National Theatre of Scotland, see playwriting in Scotland now?
I think it's been quite quiet for a while. And by quiet, I don't mean that as a negative thing. I just mean there's times when it becomes louder and has more voice and shouts more, and there's times when it isn't. And I think it feels like it's about to kind of get quite noisy again, which I think is really exciting. And that's a mixture of things. That's about, you know, slightly more experienced writers who go off and do other things before they come back with new plays, like Zinnie, who's been working very successfully in television, you know, and has then written The Fall. It's about people that run organisations and their taste. It's about all of those things changing. Also, we've just appointed a literary manager, which we decided we wouldn't do when we started. I'm always a great one for saying we can change anything we do so we don't get stuck in anything. But we kind of presumed that because of mine and John Tiffany's background, we would probably by osmosis be more supportive to developing writers. Of course, with the pressure of the job, that doesn't happen. So having a literary manager for us again means that playwriting, rather than playwrights working with us to make shows, which is what we've used them for or worked with them for up to this point, can become really important again. And again, you know, this autumn we're doing 4 brand new plays by writers who've never been performed professionally before, in association with the Travis. That's a breakthrough for both organisations as well.
And you mentioned the Travis, and there's a debate to be had, or has been had, about the Travis's position in recent years, but it's now looking forward. It has a new director in the shape of Dominic Hill, and presumably you, the NTS, consider the Travis to be a partner rather than a rival when it comes to new writing, as it defines itself as Scotland's new writing theatre.
Yeah, absolutely. I always say the stronger someone like the Travis is, the better we are as well. It's not the opposite at all. And I think that's the case with all kind of theatre, actually, in Scotland. Specifically, I think what's very exciting about Dominic, looking forward, is that he's a fearless artist, and that is what we desperately try to be here. Of course, fearless artists need friends to help them be fearless, so when you kind of can find that sort of symbiosis, I think it feels like we're really excited about what that future is with the Travis. I mean, just us being able to suddenly go, we're going to do these 4 plays together, and just doing it is a really brilliant thing. It's not about having to ask too many questions. But I think Dominic's programme for the festival is thrilling. I want to go and see every single thing. You know, that's a fantastic message to be giving out, and it feels really confident.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about Dominic's programme, because he's made a very clear choice that Travis won should be for the ambitious, large-scale new work, and that Travis 2 should really, for the first time, be exclusively given over to emerging artists, or almost exclusively. And that seems to me to be an interesting and ambitious decision for the Travis to make.
Do you think that it's that clear? I mean, it's interesting. I haven't kind of done that analysis on it, so I kind of hadn't thought about that before you asked me that question. I think it is an interesting decision. I think, though, that there are shows that could also have been in Travis 1 that are in Travis 2. So I think it's a big decision to make, but I also think I will know. There's some pragmatism around it as well, in terms of where things will fit and where they won't. I'm sure there's that aspect to it.
I suppose what I mean is, in terms of supporting emerging artists in Scotland, in the past there's been an allegation made by myself, among others, that too often at the Travis, under the previous director, playwrights had their work put on stage before they were really ready.
Yeah.
They were put in the glare of Travis 1, they were giving it a bigger production than really they were quite prepared for.
Yeah.
It seems to me that seeing Travis 2 during the festival as being a sort of hothouse for the, you know, for growing this new work is an interesting choice to make.
I mean, I think that's a brilliant observation. I think also that's very exciting, because it's about, you know, one of the aspects of our work is about having workshop productions which are run through the new work department, and it's about where can you put risk. And it's not about the decision to make the work, which is risky. It's about how much risk can you put around it in terms of pressure on audience size and then income and all of those things. And I think it's fantastic that there is still a place where that out-and-out risk can take place, but it's calculated economically, not artistically, which means that people can again be more fearless around it. So I think that's fantastic.
And you know, we're talking about the new playwrights or the younger, many of them, we talk about our young playwrights, but many of them are becoming middle-aged now.
They
but the David Greggs, the David Harrows, the Zinni Harrises, Gregory Burke, Anthony Nielsen, people like that.
Yeah.
I mean, we do have a number of very exciting playwrights. However, the flip side to that, I suppose, is that Scotland doesn't have a playwriting tradition to speak of. I mean, that's why we have Mick Molyeux, was that people were having to do Scots adaptations of Molyeux because we didn't have plays of our own, and there are various historical reasons for that, and we could discuss that all day. But
and you would know them better than I would, anyway.
But the question, I suppose, is do we have to kind of restrain ourselves a little in Scotland? And, you know, we're is it correct to be excited by the writers that we have, but it's also, do we also have to take care about making grand claims for a Scottish theatre which is only now really developing?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of find the sort of lack of formal Scottish theatre history really liberating. And I think probably those playwrights do too, and I think theatre makers in Scotland do. I think it's interesting because, you know, where we were talking about playwrights having been maybe slightly quieter, not all of them, but just over recent years, I think that's also because there's been a kind of an emergent sort of form in Scotland which is much more devised, much more sort of arches-led. So those young artists who previously might have wanted to be the young writers at the Traverse are actually reacting against something there and are working in different ways. And I think that's going round again too, that actually, not that that's ending, I think that's thrilling what's happening there, but other people are going, oh no, we can do that and we can still work with them as writers. And so there's a big, much more collaboration happening, which I think is fantastic. I think I would never, being in the moment of something, I think you can never make any grand claims for anything because everything is such a tightrope, and you know, you can't have any idea of what a movement is while it's happening, really, because it would kind of destroy it. I do think, though, that, and this is possibly a sort of naive view, but I think there's something fascinating about Scotland's complex sense of identity because of England that has made those playwrights of my generation, I can't say young because I'm definitely not, but playwrights of my generation have a very thrilling voice that they want to discover in terms of what that identity is, which, say, English playwrights haven't had the same thing to discover. So I think the kind of complexity of what Scotland is and its relatively young theatre history puts us in a brilliant position for now for making really urgent contemporary work.
You mentioned Scotland's relationship to England. You could ask, or I could ask, a mysterious question in the sense of saying that these forms in Scotland that you describe, I mean, I perceive them to have a strong relationship to international work, in particular continental Europe. In other words, much of what happens in Scotland, I don't think anyone ignores London, but it's certainly much of what happens isn't by reference to London. So I suppose the mysterious question is, is Scottish theatre therefore less parochial than London theatre?
I would absolutely agree. No question, I would say that's the case. For loads of different reasons. But I mean, I always said, even when I took this job, that the thing for me that is exciting about coming to live in Scotland and work in Scotland and create this institution in Scotland is because I've always perceived Scotland as a really outward-looking country in terms of its interests. I don't know, when I say that, quite a lot of Scottish people look at me like I'm not quite sure that it feels like that, but nowhere feels like that where you are. But I think that's always been the case. I think there's always been, and the thing I think is great about it, that is very, very different from England, is there is a different class system in Scotland, and there is a much greater sense of a kind of fundamentally left-wing country. The irony of saying this to you, you've obviously twisted my head to say this, but and therefore what theatre is and what theatre becomes. And I think that's why there isn't that long elite to hit theatre history as well. And that is much closer to many international companies and works and ideas. So politically, I think we kind of, we cross over, you know, we bridge over England and we look down occasionally and say, what is it, what's interesting there? But, you know, the things that we're interested in are the things that have also come from, you know, the complicities, the knee highs, the companies that have actually also looked elsewhere.
Yeah. And you mentioned in passing there the Archers Theatre in terms of the way in which it's allowed particularly young artists to experiment. That's going to change now in the sense that Andy Arnold, the director of 17 years, has now gone to the Tron. And as I mentioned, there's Archers type work, in fact, one Archers production, being shown at the Traverse during the festival. So, in a sense, that kind of canvas has just broadened.
Yeah.
But the Archers is yet to appoint its new director. I mean, that seems to me to be an important appointment for Scottish theatre.
Definitely. And, you know, it's a question of, does the Archers want to do more of what it's doing and better, or does it see its position as changing? I think what's also interesting is that there was a very healthy sort of paradox, I think, in the choices that Andy made himself to direct, and then some of the companies that are emerging and that he worked with, and with Jackie that he worked with. And it's interesting about, without Andy directing those kind of shows, which got really big audiences, which were often Andy's brilliantly sort of maverick take on quite conventional plays, actually. Pinter and Beckett is never conventional, but you know, things that people have heard of. And what that will mean without that there. But the Tron is also a really good place to take that taste to, I think, in the way that Andy does it. So I'm really excited about that sort of shift, and I think it probably won't be seismic. I think it'll just be a kind of bit of a kind of the kind of tectonic plates shifting a little bit around for people to be able to be the best of themselves at the next point in their career. I think it's really good.
Again, just a little shift. I mean, I wrote recently on Theatre Voice, on the blog, funnily enough, about some of the weaknesses I perceive in playwriting in Scotland, particularly to do with theatre economies, particularly to do with the fact that people... It's difficult to have the ambition to write the big play if you don't just think the money isn't going to be there to do it. Now, that's not an exclusive problem to Scotland in terms of new writing, and it's something as director of Payne's Plough you experienced for years. Yeah. So I suppose the question is, is that a problem? Is new writing being hampered by the economic reality that for most playwrights the idea of having more than five actors in a play is just unrealistic?
It's the monstrists, isn't it? It's their argument that from coming up in England that it was about 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, there's an economic issue about how do you get big audiences to new plays when nobody's heard anything of them, if you don't get anybody famous in them. Really straightforward. I think that economic issue, however, does hamper playwrights as they develop to be able to think about how to write bigger plays and how to write more characters and what that should be. So I think it's difficult, and I think we have a responsibility at the National Theatre to enable, to open those doors to playwrights and go, it could look like this, or it could look like that, or it could be like this, or it could be like that. Actually, you only get the confidence to do that if you start to begin to see that work and can relate to it and know what it looks like, know what it can feel like, know what you're reacting against or moving to. So I think that has been an issue. I also think, you know, I think Blackbird is a really interesting example about context. And actually, you don't need to have 15 people in a play to write a huge piece of theatre. And I think that was a real breakthrough for me as well, seeing Blackbird at the first preview in Peter Stein's production at the Edinburgh International Festival, going, this is a play that anyone else would have got from David and gone, oh, brilliant, it's a two-hander, we can do it in Travis too, or whatever, not literally, but you know. And going, if you put it on that big stage, the audience explores the themes differently. You work around it in a different way. That I find absolutely thrilling about theatre. And I think in part, what we would want to be able to do is to go, you don't need to write a play for 15 or 20 people, but this is what your plays can look like with the big ideas shown to an audience in a different way, so they can become a more important piece of writing.
Another question on the same theme is, in addition to economies, is it somehow a facet of modernism to write small-scale plays or plays for fewer characters? I'm thinking about Pinter, about Beckett. I mean, you know, these are not by and large plays that are full of characters.
No, you're right. And if you look at real breakthrough writers like Carol Churchill or Sarah Kane, I kind of often wonder what Sarah Kane would be writing now. I think she'd probably be writing, you know, The Scream or something. Or Carol Churchill's plays, in a way, become purer and purer. I think if you're a writer who really plays with form, you end up almost with a blank space which says everything. And I think that's really fascinating. However, there are also big stories that need to be told in big epic ways, and there are other kinds of writers that want to tell story in a different way, and they're not exploring form in theatre. Those are the plays that can bear the kind of bigger cast and the more kind of epic rolling nature of the kind of Peer Gyntism of the writing or something. But they're very hard now, I think, for us to know how to structure, because I think the kind of formal structure of the sort of, well, probably from the sort of 17th century onwards up until the middle of last century, enabled not brilliant writers to fit into a structure to tell big stories, and the structure would support them. We don't write in five-act structures anymore, or even three-act structures, so it's a challenge, I think, for contemporary playwrights to find the structures to tell those big stories in, because we work much harder now. I don't think we've cracked that yet, but I think that's exciting.
And just to ask you a broader question about Scottish theatre, I mean, you, not only have you been in this position at the NTS for 2 years, more than 2 years, but you've also been involved via Payne's Play with Scottish Theatre for a long time. And indeed John Tiffany, your associate director through the Traverse. So, given the changes which take place inevitably within a theatre culture, do you think that Scottish Theatre, the NTS notwithstanding, you know, even if the NTS could be taken out of the equation, is Scottish Theatre in a stronger or weaker position now than it was, say, a decade ago?
It's really hard, isn't it? I think all theatre goes on such a kind of roller coaster about when it is most successful, when it's not. And often its strength isn't about what the audience thinks either. You know, it's often not about the size, the amount of people who are going to shows or what they think, because I think the broad term of theatre, so obvious really, but the broad term of theatre is so massive. You know, a full house at the Bar in St Andrews in June is really different to whether something at the Arches is happening that's important, that means theatre is going to be successful in the future. So I think there are loads of different ways of looking at that. I think in terms of its reputation, its confidence, in terms of the raising the bar and breaking boundaries, with or without the National Theatre, Scotland is really, really healthy at the moment. I think the amount of funding, so in terms of ideas, and people's confidence to make those, put those ideas into theatre, I think it's fantastic. I think in terms of funding and in terms of the complexity of the kind of cultural landscape, which has shifted so much in the last 3 to 4 years from the Cultural Commission to now, and we still don't know where we are. I think that it looks very different. The infrastructure has changed. There are less companies funded. So for the audiences, there's probably less work happening, which is not a good thing. And certain kinds of work aren't happening, which is also not a good thing. But those two things can be separated.
I have to ask you this question in relation to that, because the NTS was set up in a situation in which the politicians absolutely assured everyone that the money would be ring-fenced, that the money that went into the NTS would not be at any point money which would be taken from the rest of the infrastructure. But there's now a situation through the NTS's co-productions with a whole variety of companies, particularly Scottish companies, there's now a perception that it can be, either already is or certainly in the future can be, for the Scottish Arts Council or its successor, Creative Scotland, there can be a situation where you can simply see the NTS is subsidising them. The NTS co-produces with other companies. That NTS money therefore goes to these other Scottish companies, and therefore the purse strings don't have to be opened up by by Creative Scotland for Scottish theatre. Is that a concern?
It's always a concern. It's something I fight really, really hard against, kind of internally in a kind of or privately, I mean, in a kind of advocacy role, but also hopefully in the future also more publicly about that. I think that we can't be seen as an excuse for other work not to happen, and I've always said that we have to be additional to, not instead of, always, and you know, that's what the promise was. I think that, however, I think that because of the kind of, as I say, the sort of greyness around what that cultural landscape is, there's a potential, it's easy for us to become a scapegoat in that situation in terms of decisions that would have been made anyway. But it's easy to go, well, the National Theatre of Scotland is doing that now, or they will do that. I've always said I have no strategic responsibility to anything other than to the National Theatre of Scotland putting on good work. And it's really important that we maintain that, because as soon as I cross over that line, then those decisions that the Arts Council make do become my responsibility. If I say, you know, we might have a whole year when all that happens is I direct 10 shows, and that would be fine. And that might happen, that would not be, but you know, that would happen. National Theatre of Scotland could do that, and my board would let me do that. No one can stop that from happening if the ideas are good and they're going to the right place. So therefore, we're not safe in that. So the Arts Council have to make their decisions instead of us, in spite of us, I think. But it's something which is a concern, and it's something which ongoing we will kind of keep discussing. And I'm hopeful that when we come out of something into whatever the next stage will be, we can be a bit more robust about setting those conversations.
In terms of these co-productions that we're discussing, I mean, the recent Critics Awards for Theatre in Scotland, Peer Gynt, which is a co-production between the NTS and Dundee Rep, swept the board. The previous year, Blackwatch, which was exclusively an NTS production, swept the board. And are you equally proud of both?
Unbelievably so. And I'm proud of both because of what they are artistically. And that's literally the only thing that I go on. And also audience reaction and, you know, critical reaction and response to it. So when my experience of seeing Peer Gynt was as thrilling, if not more, because I had a higher expectation of it, because it's a much tougher play, to achieve what it achieved. So for me, I'm deeply proud of it. And equally, when our shows don't work and co-productions don't work, they also feel the same feeling of shame as well.
And that's an important question, I think, is this issue of what people think of the NTS's co-productions. I mean, I know there's a school of thought, which I most certainly don't subscribe to, which sort of relegates the significance of the NTS's input into co-productions. You know, you sort of say, oh, well, Peer Gynt was a Dundee Rep production with NTS money, and as if NTS doesn't deserve credit, whereas I would argue that it's quite clear that that production of Peer Gynt couldn't have taken place without the input of the NTS, and that that sort of collaboration is precisely one of the things that the NTS should be about.
Absolutely.
But, you know, so how do you feel when you hear that sort of argument? Because I'm sure you've heard it going about.
Yeah, I have. I mean, you know, I there are so many people, you know, there are so many discussions going around about what we do and how we do it and all of those things. I mean, Peer Gynt is an example for us of our best co-production, probably. And the one that we are most proud of, because we totally trust Dominic. Dominic came to us and said, the director, Dominic Hill, he said, I really want to do this. And me and James and Dominic, we talked various about what would we do with Dundee, looking at various different things. And we all knew, because of the nature of that play, that there was no way Dundee could have put that on their own, or wouldn't have programmed it either. And so what was it about? And it was Dominic going, I have an absolute vision for this, and I know how to make this play work, and it is like this. So we were engaged in the conversation about the vision of that piece of theatre working. So therefore, we feel that we enabled that to happen, and not even enabled it, we're actually part of it. So for me, that kind of argument doesn't go anywhere. And then, of course, it does come down to, well, there's the money to make you do it in that way. But the actual bit for me is the vision of it. And it wasn't just a list of plays, one of which we picked to give some money to Dundee, so they got ticked on our list of co-producers at all.
As a final question, Vicky, I mean, that's more than 2 years now you've been in this post. I mean, are you happy with the work thus far? And what do you see as the future of the company and the future of your role in the company?
I think I'm probably happy with about, I mean, this is just picking it off the shelf, I'm probably happy about 40% of what we've done, really happy. And I think 60% of it could have been much, much, much better. That's really good, because we've been lucky enough to do enough productions for the 40% to really matter, if it is indeed that high. And the 60% for us to really learn from. And the fact that we've never set out to have a kind of boring 5-year action plan of things that we should do means that as soon as we do something and we learn from it, we're able to change the way that we do something in the future. And I think we've been really good at that. The benefits of that probably haven't come outside yet, but we've been really quick to learn what's worked and what hasn't and why it hasn't, for our work that we've done ourselves and also the work that we've done in co-productions, and then learn from the ones that have worked. So I think moving forward, I think probably we're about, I'm not making any promises for the work, because you still don't know, but I feel we're kind of in a really dynamic phase of understanding how we program, how we create partnerships, how we make work well, those kind of things. So that feels really thrilling and quite surprising, that after 2 years of this, I feel really more excited than I did when I started about how we're making work and what it's going to be. And that's extraordinary, because actually to be able to have that renewed energy about this at this point, rather than kind of go, oh my god, we're now ground down by it and we've got to keep doing it, is brilliant. And that's because of work the artists. So I feel really excited about what we're work that we're doing and what we're coming up with and the future of that. So it's a similar thing actually to Animals at Payne's Plough. people say to me, you know, how long do you think you'll be at Payne's Plough and how does it feel? And for me, because we approach the work, it's kind of nearly all new work, even things that we've seen before. It's always new, so it keeps reinventing itself. So as long as those ideas are thrilling and the people that we want to work with and want to work with us are thrilling, then I think that's the heart of what it is. But I'm also very clear that, you know, we kind of see ourselves in phase three at the moment of the National Theatre, and that this phase is the sort of consolidation, but maturing, just late teenagers. So we're kind of becoming the adults that we will be, I think, shortly, that's happening. And actually, that's also about then being able to go, well, this isn't soon, but, you know, within the next few years, about, well, what does the National Theatre mean on its own, not with me here or John here or anyone else? My responsibility is to set up an organisation that doesn't need me to be here to be able to hand it on, which I feel very sad about, but, you know, all our children grow up. But, you know, yes, there's more years of this, but that's what I need to do next.
Well, that's as good a place to end as any, so yeah. Many thanks, Vicky Ferguson.
Pleasure. Thank you. Pleasure.